Welcome to Minnesota Court of Appeals. My name is John Rodenberg. I'm presiding today with Judges Riley and Brotfeld. Are both parents going to be making oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how have you decided to split your time?
Thank you, Your Honor. I previously submitted a motion to the court, and it was decided that there would be 8 minutes for both me and Mother's Counsel to make our primary argument, 2 minutes for rebuttal, if it pleased the court.
So you just want to divide your time. Instead of 15 and 5, you want to just have it be 16 and 2.
Thank you.
Yeah. Fair enough. Or 8 and 2.
Yeah.
Okay. And the county's the only, the guardian's not making any appearance, is that correct?
No.
All right. Then, Jason, if you'd set for 8, the 8 minutes, 8 minutes, and then 2 on rebuttal, and 2 and 2, I suppose, huh? Give us your name when you begin your comments and identify the party who you represent so we have that for the recording. Whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Ann Carlson on behalf of appellant father, RLW. I request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
In this case, a young boy spends the first 7.5 years of his life in the care of his mother and his father. Sometime during his 7th year, his parents stopped providing for him educationally. His parents have previously had their parental rights terminated and are fearful.
Two other children.
Are fearful of it happening again. How they handle CPS's attempt to intervene is poor. My client handled himself especially poorly by not engaging with the social worker when the social worker came to approach him to address the fact that his child was not making it to school. Now, the purpose of the Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure is to ensure safe and stable homes for children, ideally in the care of their biological parents, removing them only from the home when their safety and welfare cannot otherwise be safeguarded. And in this case, although we know that my client handled himself poorly in his interactions with CPS, and did not handle himself well in his interactions with the district court, we don't know what the relationship he had with his minor son looked like. To our knowledge, this child's needs were being met, his physical needs, his emotional needs. He was kept housed, to the best of our knowledge, for the first 7.5 years of his life. Then he is removed from the home.
Well, this judge talked about when he was finally found, because the parents moved a lot between the time that the initial report was made and the child was finally found at paternal grandpa's house, is that right?
That's correct. He was removed from his paternal grandfather's house.
And it sounds like there was quite a ruckus.
I do not think my client handled the situation as well as I would have liked him to.
And then the part of the issue was that this child at 10 a.m. in the morning slept through all of that stuff, which would wake almost anyone up.
It is concerning that it was reported that the child slept through what was a loud event, and that it was reported that the child did not have normal sleeping patterns.
And that maybe the parents gave the child sleep aids.
Possibly. That is what was reported and remains unknown. I know that someone in the house reported that there was melatonin possibly given to the child.
The other thing is that, unlike mother at the time of the trial, mother took the opportunity to have a parenting assessment with Mary McGuire. Your client refused or rejected that.
My client didn't refuse to have a parenting assessment. That was perhaps an opportunity that Mother's Council took advantage of that I did not take advantage of to get a parenting assessment scheduled. My argument throughout the case was that we wanted a case plan and an opportunity to work toward reunification.
Well, and it says that, is it Wojciech?
Yes.
Okay. Could have chosen to seek a parenting evaluation during the continuance the court granted, but declined to do so, is in the court's finding of facts.
He wasn't presented with an opportunity to get a parenting assessment. Mother's attorney made efforts to get her a parenting assessment for the purposes of rebutting the presumption. Could he have done that? He possibly could have done that, but it wasn't that he had the opportunity and refused.
Made an appointment and said, go see so-and-so.
That's a mischaracterization of what it was. When we were in court, Mother's Counsel effectively got a continuance for the purposes of getting this parenting assessment, and I did not make the same request. My request was always, please give us a case plan and an opportunity to reunify or at least find out what's going on, figure out how we got here, what this family dynamic is, what ways this child is or is not being cared for. We know that he didn't make it to school during the 2017-2018 school year, and that is important, and that is unfortunate that he didn't make it to school. But we don't know what relationship he has with his parents, and there is a responsibility of the agency to provide an out-of-home placement plan within 30 days of removal. That didn't happen here. I do have to correct an argument that I made in my brief. After further research and reading in the matter of the welfare of DLRD 656 NW 2D 247, the district court does not need to make findings when there is a previous termination under Minnesota Statute 260C.301 subdivision 1 subparent 4, the statutory presumption of palpable unfitness. I erroneously interpreted other case law that there should always be findings related to the conditions as they exist at the time of removal. I do believe that it is important to look at the conditions that exist at the time of removal and important to work with families towards reunifying or towards figuring out if reunification is an option. You know, the rebuttable presumption of palpable unfitness serves a very practical purpose in that there are a lot of parents who come in and they've had several terminations to several children recently. And this is a situation where there was a termination 10 years prior to us coming into court. I would have liked them to have handled, I would have liked my client to have handled the situation differently, certainly. Well, but it's understandable.
The problem, as I read the record, is that he made himself scarce from October till April. And then it wasn't that he came to the county and said, I want a case plan. It was that they tracked him down. And also, he said there was no way he was going to work with them.
If I may finish your question.
Certainly.
Look, my client is not an attorney, and he made poor choices prior to getting court-appointed counsel. And I believe that once he had court-appointed counsel, who would have been able to guide him in the direction of understanding the importance of working with Child Protective Services toward doing what is necessary to correct this condition. There could have been a remedy here. And his poor legal choices were unfortunate, but they aren't reflective of the relationship that he has with his son.
Thank you. You will have the rebuttal time as discussed. Counsel for the mother.
Thank you. Good morning. Excuse me. May I please the court, counsel? My name is Mackenzie Guptill. I'm here on behalf of my client, JMG, the mother of this child, and one of the appellants. As the court's seen from the briefs and heard already from cross-appellant or other appellant's counsel, this is a situation where the minor child was raised by his parents for the first 7 years of his life. There was a separation based on a court order and based on interdiction or intervention by law enforcement and Health and Human Services from Chisago County that happened in Minneapolis. It happened in April, I believe, of 2018. And at August of 2018, we were at a trial regarding TPR. The petition for TPR was filed roughly about a week to 10 days after the removal of the minor child based on the prior TPRs that happened for both parties 10 years prior. The concern brought and articulated throughout not only the trial, but also leading up to that trial was how the attachment of a minor child that's raised by both parents would be effectuated or how that would result as it relates to the development of that child if a termination was allowed.
And I want to focus on the child because obviously it's the best interests of the child.
Yes.
That's paramount. And you make the argument that the district court improperly considered the child's diagnostic assessment. Mm-hmm. But could you articulate your argument more, flesh that out more, because I'm not sure that I understand why you think it was improper.
The concern often with diagnostic assessments or psychological collateral or psychological assessments are what are the collateral documents or resources that are used first and foremost by that assessor to determine the initial diagnoses. So in this specific situation, when a diagnostic evaluator meets with the minor child and then takes collateral information from the foster care provider, and I believe in that foster care provider's representations, there might have been some incorporation of arguments that there was PTSD associated with the child's upbringing, violence that the child may have seen, and of course I'm paraphrasing. But the concerns that exist about that is, generally, we don't see the collateral person testify at trial. For example, the foster care person did not testify at this trial. The assessor took that information from the provider, and I think Ms. McGuire's testimony also was there's a concern that that diagnostic evaluator didn't have contact with mom. And so it's more looking at the idea that there needs to be more of a complete picture in identifying if the collateral information was verifiable. And that is a concern, especially when we're looking at a determination of whether or not a child has PTSD, what's the PTSD related to, if the child may have reactive attachment disorder, what's that related to? And so that goes into a concern of really whether or not the child's issues at the time that the evaluation was done are related to the upbringing or related to the separation or related to the continuing separation of mom. You know, we certainly understand that there was that traumatic event that existed during the removal, and there's been some discussion, obviously, about that. But when we talk about a child that has a connection to parents, in my case, you know, we're arguing he has a significant connection to mother. The idea that now we're looking at severing that bond after 7 years, you know, it is akin to having a death of that parent, which I've heard it argued even could be worse because you know that that parent's out there. So those are the concerns I think needed to be more investigated. And the argument, again, going off of your question for the diagnostic, was there are collateral things that are brought in that we would articulate or argue could be deemed as hearsay. That's the concern. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I know that I kind of jumped to the crux of the concern about the issues related to the attachment of mother and son and whether or not in this specific situation the best interest was really effectively evaluated by the court. Certainly, the arguments in the brief started out with whether or not we rebutted the statutory presumption.
What you just, and we'll talk about this with the county, my understanding is the parent has the burden of production.
Yes. Yes. And so, and again, our argument would be that we rebutted that burden of production based on the testimony of Ms. McGuire, who took the position that she is not, meaning my client, is not palpably unfit and would have the ability to reunify. She recommended a case plan and identified through her testimony that she thought, yes, sorry.
So it seems to me in the district court's findings, mm-hmm. although maybe not explicitly stated, it was implicit that the district court determined that Mary McGuire's testimony was not credible or entitled to much weight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that district courts, we rely on district courts to do.
I think I covered that in my brief. I mean, certainly one of the things that was a little unusual about the progression in this case is that prior to trial, we had asked for some time, I had asked for some time to get an evaluation because I think I was brought on as court-appointed counsel very late in the process at the pretrial.
You were handicapped, definitely.
Certainly.
Both of you were.
Certainly, and I think that the record does identify that I made some spirited attempts to try to extend the process so that we could get this evaluation, which I thought was necessary under the circumstances. The court met us kind of halfway by identifying that we'll give you a little bit of a break, not much. I think it was about 3 weeks, and the court identified that the court was comfortable with a verbal opinion and verbal testimony. So I understand that one of the things that was difficult from the court's perspective was the idea that the guardian ad litem hadn't been contacted. But again, going back to the question, well, courts weigh credibility all the time. The first thing we have to do is start out with, did we rebut the burden of production?
So this is why I think the court ultimately, if I'm reading the court's opinion, your client, I think, was in a different position than father. But your client also seemed, the court kept saying, mother chose father. Mm-hmm. And so the concern, I think, of the district court going forward is mom is not going to disengage from father and raise this child.
And I think that certainly that's the calculated hypothetical by the court.
Well, and that was, I think, part of Mary McGuire's assessment that mom on her own could perhaps do it.
So,
and she assumed that mom was going to do it without dad.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm wrong in my assessment of that.
No, I would take the position that you are correct, that we're looking at a best-case scenario where Ms. McGuire is saying, look, you can do this. If you're offered the services and offered interventions and you follow those tasks, you could do it. And again, the testimony from Ms. McGuire was 6 months. And certainly I understand the court's, again, calculated hypothesis. It's also important to note, yes, there was a relationship between these parties that was extensive. I'm sorry, it looks like I'm over. Can I finish the question?
You can finish your response for sure.
The problem with these parties is that mom started dating dad when she was 15. He's 10 years older than she is.
And so, she had children that he probably could have been prosecuted for.
That is correct. And more to the point, if they were living together all the way through, you could still make that argument that the statute of limitations hasn't expired. So that's the concern, but again, to the burden of production, she testified, Ms. McGuire, that she was able to parent. Then we go to the analysis, and I think that's the issue, is that for the court to then jump kind of to the end game, there still needs to be that intervention and at least that trial attempt. Thank you. Rebuttal, if I could. Thank you.
You will have 2 minutes as discussed. County, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Janine Putnam. I represent Chisago County Health and Human Services, the respondent in this matter. I'd like to start just by stating that Chisago County did get involved with this family in October of 2017. The child wasn't ultimately removed from the care of his parents until April 5th, 2018. And the county is today asking that the panel affirm the August 28th termination order with regard to both parents. I'd like to start with the presumption of palpable unfitness. As the panel is aware, the standard of review on that issue of whether or not the parents have rebutted the presumption is de novo. I would like to point the court's attention to In Re TD, which is found at 731 Northwest 2nd 548. It's a Minnesota Court of Appeals decision, and I think it very clearly describes what the burden on the parents was at trial. That case notes that the assumed fact when this presumption applies is that the parents are unfit. Unfitness is the presumed fact. So what the parent needs to do is present sufficient evidence of parental fitness. And here, neither parent did that. Father didn't present any evidence on that issue at all, and the mother's evidence, as the district court found, was based on an incomplete picture of the situation. It didn't take into consideration the father's continued prominence in the mother's life, and it was also based predominantly on the mother's self-reporting.
You would agree with me, we have looked high and low for a case that involves truancy, educational neglect, that so quickly went to a TPR.
I would absolutely agree with Your Honor, but I think as frequently happens in cases that come in as educational neglect, the initial report that brought the case to the attention of the county was in fact ed neglect, but that wasn't the full picture. At the time that the county attempted to engage the parents voluntarily and even involuntarily, the predominant issue that the county workers were focusing on was getting that child to school. However, in the interim, a slew of other issues came to the county's attention. There were reports of chemical abuse, reports of violence in the home, reports of chronic homelessness. Now, whether that homelessness was self-inflicted by the parents choosing to continue moving from residence to residence is unknown, but there were additional issues. And at the end of the day, there are those two prior involuntary terminations. And I do acknowledge, you know, these terminations happened 10 years ago. But there's nothing in the statute that requires a frequency of termination or a recency of termination in order for this presumption to apply. What the issue is have the parents done anything to fix the circumstances, make themselves fit?
Not only did palpably unfit prong, you also did that they failed to comply with the duties of the parent-child relationship.
Correct.
And that prong requires the county to have a case plan and to make reasonable efforts.
Well, I would concede that it does require the county to make reasonable efforts, but the district court found that the county did make reasonable efforts.
Except, in my experience, the county at the outset will say, can we be relieved of reasonable efforts and not put forth a case plan? And looking through the record, I don't see that the county ever made that request or that the court ever affirmatively granted that request.
The court didn't at any time affirmatively relieve the county of the duty to make reasonable efforts. But as the district court found, the county did make reasonable efforts. And I'd like to...
What's the case plan?
Well, I'd like to draw the court's attention to a number of cases where a termination was not reversed
based on
a lack of case plan.
I'm asking specifically in this case, where is the case plan in the
record? There is no case plan in this case. But I'd like to draw the panel's attention to In Re RMM, which is found at 316 Northwest 2nd 538. In that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court did not reverse a termination despite the lack of a case plan where the parent did not engage with the county for case planning purposes. I think this record is very clear, and the district court's findings are very clear, that the father in this case adamantly refused to engage with the county. That continued through the entirety of the termination trial. At one point mid-trial, the county was ordered to facilitate supervised phone contact between the father and the child, and the father would not even cooperate with the social worker to schedule that phone call. That had to be done through the mother. I'd also point to In Re RW, which is found at 678 Northwest 2nd 49, where the Minnesota Supreme Court rejected the idea that a case plan must be provided, quote, to parents who have shown but minimal interest or involvement with their children or the CHIPS proceeding, end quote. Here, obviously, the father was interested in his child. He didn't believe the child should ever have been removed, but he also failed to be timely or present for court hearings. He failed to engage with the social worker. He was aggressive. He was confrontational. Visitation in this case had to be done in a secure building because there were concerns about the father's conduct and his threatening and aggressive behavior. And the last case I draw the panel's attention to on that issue is In Re JJLB, which is found at 394 Northwest 2nd 858, where the Minnesota Court of Appeals concluded that failure to provide a case plan doesn't require reversal where, first, the parent's failure to cooperate and transitory lifestyle contributed to the case plan not being created, which I think is clear on this record, and second, where the parent was aware of what needed to be done to correct the concerning conditions. Now, I agree that a case plan is typically what is needed for that to be the case, but here we have parents, specifically on this issue with regard to the father. He was very aware that during the voluntary stages of this case, what he needed to do was get the child to school. And beyond that, he was aware, based on the prior termination, the previous reasonable efforts, the previous case plans, statements by the social workers throughout this plan, that the prior concerns of chemical dependency, mental health issues, violence, homelessness, all continued to be a problem. So I don't believe that there's an argument here that the father didn't know what he needed to do. Even if the panel determined that the presumption didn't apply, the county is of the position that the district court was not clearly erroneous when it found that the county did make reasonable efforts. With regards to the mother's other challenges, I would just note, as I noted in my brief, that her complaints with the record and the district court's findings don't actually appear to be challenges to the facts themselves. She doesn't point to a fact and say, the child was diagnosed with, and I should note, this child was never diagnosed with PTSD or reactive attachment disorder. But she doesn't point to the diagnosis and say there's no assessment in the record to support that finding. She doesn't point to the finding that she has a history of chemical dependency issues and claim there's no support of that in the record. She's basically assigning error to the district court's weight of the various facts and factors. And a disagreement by the mother regarding the weight assigned to various factors in determining a termination is appropriate and in determining that a termination is in the best interest of the children is not the same as there being clear error. Just because the mother believes that the preservation of that relationship should have been weighted more heavily than the child's competing interests does not mean that the district court abused its discretion in concluding otherwise. With that, unless the panel has additional questions, I'd yield the rest of my time.
It appears we have none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Carlson, 2 minutes.
The argument that I hear is that father knew what he was supposed to do to remedy the conditions. I can assure you, father had no idea what he was supposed to do. And that is why we're here. Father followed his own erroneous legal advice of attempting to make an argument that there was no jurisdiction over him and his child who did or did not live in the county. To say the father knew how he could correct the conditions that led to out-of-home placement prior to being given a case plan is, I would just strongly disagree with the fact that this man had a sense of that. And the fact that he has child protection history doesn't mean that he is someone who is now learned in the process of what it takes to have a child return to his care. What I fear we're doing in this case is we're not terminating because termination is in the best interest of the child. We're terminating because we want to punish the parents for the way they interacted with social services. That is not the reason that the rules of juvenile protection procedure exist. We are supposed to be looking out for this child's best interest, and we are supposed to be doing that by attempting to reunify families. The rules are meant to save the savable. Now, I know that the record has a lot of bad words about my client. He's aggressive, he's assertive, he's this, he's that, he's every other thing that any bad word you can think of, someone somewhere has described him as being that. My reading of it is that all has to do with the way that he interacted with the social workers, which was poorly. I completely concede he acted poorly in their presence, but I have no idea how he was interacting with his son, what relationship he had there, or why it is really in this child's best interest that we make a decision that we sever ties to the parent-child relationship that he has had for 7.5 years.
Thank you. Mr. Guptill.
Thank you. As briefly as I can, although there might be some argument about whether or not certain facts were confirmed or not disputed with regard to the best interest analysis, the concern about the overall record with regard to the court's adoption of the findings of fact have been refuted, have been disagreed with, and have been argued, I think, at least by me in the brief, with regard to a multitude of the findings that existed by the court. We've taken, and I have, objection to the idea that the county did provide services, that the county did provide effective services throughout the process that existed. I think Ms. Zierden, the social worker, testified, and it's identified in the brief, that there wasn't services that were provided outside of visitation and hair follicle testing. And the reason why I point that out is that the guardian ad litem, what I would say when looking at the record, and it was quoted in our brief, goes back and forth on what the best interest should be for the minor child and takes, I think, a specific stance that ultimately a termination is in the child's best interest given the fact that there wasn't participation by the parents. And the problem that exists with that is that the child was removed in April, and then a TPR started right away. And we've disputed, and I have throughout the brief, on what specific information mom knew at the outset as far as the county's participation.
And you're counting outset as the fall?
Yes. Yes. And then we'd point out, just to finish, the idea that exists here is that in the three factors that are looked at, we have the parent's interest, the child's interest, and then we look at the competing interest, but we have this issue of health. And it's our concern that we don't know enough about his mental health. So yes, there's refute, if I may just finish.
Yeah, you can finish your comment.
The diagnostic assessments talk about the idea that there is a rule out, that they need to look at whether or not there is reactive attachment or whether or not there is PTSD, and there was recommended to have a full psychological evaluation. So we don't know what extent the child's mental health is and how that's interrelated to the severance of the parent connection. And so when we look at the competing interest, we talk about health of the child, but I also think that's a significant factor that needs to be put together in the equation on what's in his best interest. And that's the concern. The case law talks about every case is different and every case needs to be a detailed evaluation.
I'm trying to remember the date of the assessment of the child.
I am going to make basically an educated guess. It was June 11th.
Okay, thank
That's
you.
Not an educated guess. That's assistance from Learned Counsel.
Good guess, though.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Thank you very much.
All right, we thank all of counsel. The matter is submitted pursuant to our court's rules, and because it's a child welfare matter, we'll issue our decision within 45 days. Thank you. We're going to take